will be able to do a direct comparison from the substances that were leaching from the shoreline last summer and this event.
Shishmaref residents spot the return of a mysterious oily sheen. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, scientists make new discoveries about an animal that doesn't get much attention in Alaska, the bat.
Those old dead bats are incredibly valuable scientifically, even if it looks rotten and crushed.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
Alaska Pacific University now offers the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. More at 1-800-272-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
A mysterious oily sheen found along the northeast coast of Shishmaref this summer has returned. The sheen was first discovered in June on the near shore ice pack by the Shishmaref Village Public Safety Officer. The VPSO reported the yellow liquid smelled like gasoline. That led to cleanup efforts and an investigation by the State Department of Environmental Conservation to determine exactly what the substance was and where it came from. Samples of the sheen and from the community's fuel tanks were collected for testing at the U.S. Coast Guard's Marine Safety Lab in Connecticut. But the summer cleanup efforts ended with results still pending and no source for the sheen was identified. Now the sheen is back, noticed by a local store owner and the VPSO last week. DEC officials say the unidentified substance again has the strong scent of gasoline and was first noticed underneath nearshore ice as early as last Friday. DEC spokeswoman Ashley Adamczak says the agency sent someone to Shishmaref today to investigate. She says those samples collected over the summer will come in handy.
We will be able to do a direct comparison from the substances that were leaching from the shoreline last summer and this event and compare that back to the tank farm.
Adamczak says locals in Shishmaref have offered input on where the oily substance could be coming from, and DEC is following up.
There's a lot of people there that have a lot more history of that site than we do. There's a couple different floating theories that we have, and we are actually taking a metal detector device out there to do some investigation and see if there's any subsurface tanks or buried drums that are in the area, and we'll be working very closely with the people that reported that those might be there to determine an exact location.
The Coast Guard is sending two pollution responders that are on the way to Shishmaref, as well as two employees of waste treatment company Emerald Alaska to perform an on-site assessment. The summer cleanup in the wake of the sheen's first appearance resulted in about 30 bags of oily waste from absorbent materials laid out over an area of 1,200 square feet. About 100 gallons of the fuel-like substance were recovered. Governor Bill Walker is striking an optimistic tone despite tanking oil prices that are reducing state revenue. Speaking to the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce on Tuesday, Walker pointed to opportunity. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Governor Bill Walker told an assemblage of Fairbanks business and government leaders Alaska can wend its way through the oil price drop.
We have to acknowledge it. But we will manage our way out of the situation. We will build our way out of the situation.
Walker said he agrees with President Obama that the country is suffering from an infrastructure deficit, something he says they discussed during a recent meeting.
I said, Mr. President, I couldn't agree with you more. Let me tell you about this one project in Alaska we've been looking at for quite a while. And we talked about the gas pipeline.
Walker said the president pointed to the potential for expedited federal permitting for the natural gas project. The governor committed to continuing assessment of both a large diameter LNG export pipeline and an in-state gas line to provide energy for Alaskans, saying decisions on the projects will not be dictated by private industry.
That's one thing I'm focused on in this review process, to make sure that a company elsewhere who may have other competing interests can't say we're going to wait another 10 years on an energy project for Alaska. We can't wait 10 years.
Walker expressed support for in-state oil refining and production of alternative fuels like wood pellets and reiterated a campaign pledge to lower in-state energy costs.
That's the rising tide that floats a lot of boats in this state is low-cost energy. So I've long felt that Fairbanks should be the Edmonton of Alaska with the cheapest energy because you're the closest energy mecca, 400 miles north. We need to figure that out.
Walker did not provide specifics, but said he's working to significantly bring down interior energy costs this winter. He emphasized that as an independent, he has no political agenda and can be creative.
We're going to do some things that will have people scratching their heads, but I think they'll also be saying thank you because they'll realize that our priorities really are about jobs for Alaska and cheap energy.
Walker acknowledged that Alaska's currently declining oil revenue stream is forcing a tough look at funding for big projects like the proposed Susitna Hydro Dam, which is among several slated for cuts in his capital spending plan. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Scientists are in a race to learn as much as they can about bats in Alaska. And that race has led to the discovery of two species previously unknown in the state. The hoary bat and the Yuma bat were both found in southeast Alaska. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Bat research in the state has been accelerating over the last several years as scientists anticipate the spread of white nose syndrome in bat species and the effects of climate change. This surge in research uncovered two different bat species never before documented in Alaska. Specimens of the Yuma bat, or Yuma myotis, have actually been in museum collections for nearly 30 years, but they were incorrectly identified. Link Olson is the curator of mammals at the University of Alaska Museum of the North. He says that's largely because, on the surface, the Yuma bat looks very similar to a more common, well-documented species called the little brown bat.
If I were to go down to southeast Alaska and catch a bat that could either be a Yuma bat or a little brown bat, without any other information or evidence, if I were to look at it and then let it go, or even if I were to take the measurements that you can take from a live bat in the hand, I would not be able to confidently identify it as one or the other.
And Olson doesn't believe his colleagues would claim to be able to make the distinction either. Though the two species might look alike, he says they aren't closely related, which gives scientists other avenues to identify the bats.
What we can do is collect tiny bits of tissue, and we usually do this from either the wing or the tail membranes because they heal very rapidly. And with that tiny little punch or biopsy of tissue, we can use very straightforward genetic techniques to identify these two particular species.
The second species previously unknown in Alaska is the hoary bat. Scientists don't have any physical specimens of the species from within the state, but they were able to detect the species by using ultra-sensitive audio equipment that can pick up the bat's echolocation signals, which are typically outside of the human hearing range.
These bat detectors will record those and either display them in a typical sonogram so that we can compare them to known reference calls and hopefully identify them to species, which is what was done in this case, or they will divide that echolocation call by a denominator that literally breaks it down and divides it so that it's in our hearing range.
Though the identification was successful in the case of the hoary bat, Olson says species can't always be accurately identified by their echolocation alone. The range of the bats is not known, but in the case of the Yuma bat, Olson says specimens from other collections are from as far north as Baranof Island, and he suspects it might extend even further north.
There's no clear biogeographic barrier that I can think of to this species until you get up to the Malaspina Glacier, north of Yakutat.
There are plenty of other unknowns regarding Alaska's bats, including where they spend their winters. Olson says that question still looms, even for the better-documented little brown bat. This question is particularly pressing because bats are most susceptible to white nose syndrome while they're hibernating. As bat research progresses, Olson says citizen science has become a critical component because many of the museum's specimens were discovered by citizens, not scientists.
Those old dead bats are incredibly valuable scientifically. Even if it looks rotten and crushed, there's scientific value in that specimen.
Olson says if you do run across a dead or dying bat, alert Fish and Game or a local biologist rather than picking it up yourself. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new building opens up new possibilities for Sea Alaska Heritage Institute.
It's really a flexible space. It's a multi-use space, and it's an educational space.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by Raven Alaska, navigating Alaska's challenging terrain, serving more than 100 communities statewide. Details at raven.com. Raven Alaska, soaring above.
Tribes in Alaska are celebrating a decision that allows them to apply for lands to be placed into trust status with the federal government. The Interior Department published the final regulation in a long-running dispute between tribes, Interior, and the state over an interpretation of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, or ANCSA, in 1971 that held tribes in Alaska had lost that trust right under the Settlement Act. Native American Rights Fund attorney Heather Kendall Miller sued on behalf of four tribes and one Alaska Native individual in 2006.
So this is a huge, wonderful day to see Alaska tribes be able to fully exercise the right to have their petitions considered.
The District Court for D.C. rejected the state of Alaska's position that ANCSA required different treatment of tribes in Alaska. The state is appealing that decision. Kendall Miller says one of the plaintiffs is the Chilkoot Indian Association that had land donated to it by a church. The 160 acres are in Haines, and applying for trust status means local municipalities, boroughs, or the state would not be allowed to tax any economic development initiatives the tribe may develop there. Kendall Miller says the state could decide to drop the appeal now that Interior has adopted the court's decision that sided with tribes on all counts. Kendall Miller says numerous tribes beyond the plaintiffs have been preparing applications for requesting trust status. She says this land status could be considered Indian country. Chieftain Metals has released new details on its plan to barge supplies and minerals to and from the Tulsaqua Chief Mine up the Taku River south of Juneau. KTOO's Casey Kelly reports.
Chieftain is trying to reopen the long-closed zinc, copper, and gold mine in British Columbia. The company filed an updated feasibility study with Canadian financial regulators earlier this month. It says the Taku is likely to be impassable about 23% of the time during the proposed barging season from May to September. Another 23% of the time, barges will need a tug to help navigate the river. Chris Zimmer with the environmental organization Rivers Without Borders says the report is light on other details about the company's barging plan.
When you look at this, you just think, boy, how are they going to make this work? Because they've got to get concentrate out on a schedule to get it on a barge and to get it down to a freighter in Seattle. And given the conditions in the river, I just can't see how they're going to be able to make this work.
According to the feasibility report, Chieftain would need four custom-built tugs and barges to make the nearly 40-mile run from the mouth of the Taku to the Tulsaqua. The company expects to ship more than 867,000 wet metric tons of concentrate to market over the proposed 11-year life of the mine. At its operational peak, that would be more than 93,000 tons per year. About 17,000 tons of supplies and fuel would be shipped up the river every year as well. Zimmer worries about what will happen if Chieftain misses a few barge runs and tries to make them up when river conditions improve.
They're probably going to try to run a lot of barges in a very short time to make up for that shortfall. And I think they'll probably push the envelope for what's safe in the river there.
Chieftain officials have previously said the mine would not be built unless there was a road leading to it from Atlin, British Columbia. In October, the company announced the road is no longer being considered. The Taku River Tlingit First Nation has sued to stop the project, saying BC officials failed to consult them about an environmental permit. Ron Moss is the former owner of Taku Glacier Lodge and still owns about 150 acres up the river. He's disappointed in Chieftain's plan to barge.
I just really hate to see them tear up the whole damn country for a few bucks.
Moss remembers when former Tulsaqua owner Redfern Resources tried barging on the Taku and how the vessels would pass right by his property overlooking the glacier.
It's a gorgeous gorgeous, gorgeous place. And it's just a shame to have that barge coming by, and you can hear it, you know, 5 miles away.
Linden Logistics, one of the largest freight companies operating in Alaska, last month announced it had signed a non-binding letter of intent with Chieftain to provide barging services for the Tulsiqua project. Officials with both companies have declined multiple requests for comment. Chieftain is still seeking financing to reopen the Tulsiqua. Cominco last operated the mine in 1957. Juneau state lawmakers formed the Taku River Fact-Finding Task Force in 2011 to address local concern over renewed interest in the mine. Representative Kathy Munoz says the city's legislative delegation is still reviewing the updated feasibility study and will talk about getting the task force back together early next year. She says it's a high priority. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
The State Department of Environmental Conservation has reached a remote spot along the Dalton Highway where a fuel tanker wrecked and overturned Sunday night, spilling 1,200 gallons of diesel. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the spill and resulting fire occurred near the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
DEC estimates the diesel spilled over a 30 by 120 foot area, about 200 feet from an above ground section of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline near the community of Wiseman. The truck was owned by Fairbanks-based Big State Logistics, which dispatched personnel Sunday night to recover about 9,000 gallons that was still in the wrecked tanker and to conduct some initial cleanup of the area. Sometime later that night, the wrecked tractor trailer caught fire and burned up. A DEC report issued Wednesday afternoon says the fire burned vegetation within a 30-foot radius. The cause of the fire is still under investigation. Ashley Adamsack is an environmental specialist with the Fairbanks DEC office. She says the agency will be overseeing what will likely be a complex cleanup operation of the spill site in the spring, sometime around breakup.
Due to the sensitive area in northern and interior Alaska, we have to be very careful when we do our cleanup actions to ensure that our cleanup tactics don't cause more harm to the environment than if we didn't do anything.
DEC says a Fairbanks-based environmental services contractor hired by Big State conducted a limited assessment of the site on Tuesday and decided to delay further cleanup in order to bring in more equipment and due to safety concerns over flammable diesel that had soaked into the ground. Adamsack said DEC will work with the contractor, Alaska Resource and Environmental Services, to ensure the cleanup operation restores the area and doesn't cause additional harm.
So we'll have to ensure that the soil that is backfilled doesn't contain any invasive species and is similar to the surroundings. So we'll have to source that material and make sure that is appropriate for that site.
Adamsack says the diesel-soaked soil will then have to be taken to a certified site, probably in Fairbanks, for remediation. Until the cleanup begins, Adamsack says preliminary work will be done to move fiber optic and electrical lines away from the excavation area. She says those lines run along the Dalton to provide power and communications for pipeline operations.
There are electrically charged lines that are buried in the ground along the Dalton Highway.
Adamsack says DEC will ensure Big State pays for the cleanup and the state's cost of overseeing the operation. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
Some Petersburg residents would like to see a fall brown bear hunt in Unit 3 near Petersburg. KFSK's Angela Denning reports.
The proposals will be considered by the State Board of Game at its meeting January 9th through the 13th in Juneau.
We like the brown bears to be relatively scarce on the island.
That's Petersburg resident Bob Martin, chairman of the Petersburg Fish and Game Advisory Committee. Unit 3 is predominantly black bear country, Brown bears are usually larger than black bears and are considered more dangerous when encountering humans.
I think the motivation for these proposals is that in recent decades, maybe last 25 years, we've become aware that there are brown bears on Mitkoff Island. And there is a brown bear hunting season in the spring. It's not really an intentional hunt on this island, but it's part of the larger Unit 3 hunting regs, and it's spring only. I don't think many people target brown bears, but people do encounter them in the fall when they're deer hunting.
Both proposals would add a fall hunt every 4 regulatory years and by permit only. One would provide a fall hunt for just Mitkoff Island, and the other would allow for a fall hunt for all of Unit 3. Unit 3 includes the islands of Mitkoff, Kuprinoff, Wrangell, QU, as well as other islands. It does not include the mainland. Martin grew up on Mitkoff Island and said they assumed there were no brown bears here because they never saw them.
We did have a lot of black bears around before the dump switched to a baler facility that ships out garbage, but I was always under the impression, and so was my family, that this was a brown bear free zone, and when you're out berry picking and other such things, it just kind of assumed you just had to make a lot of noise and you'd be fine. But then there have been a few incidents, two in particular, where deer hunters have encountered aggressive brown bears and had to shoot them. And since then, I've heard that there are quite a few brown bears on the island, especially the south end.
In the summer of 2012, there were 2 brown bears spotted near Petersburg, one at the Blind River Rapids and one at Frederick Point East. Then that fall, a 3rd brown bear was shot by some moose hunters who say it was self-defense. Rich Lowell, area wildlife biologist for Fish and Game in Petersburg, thinks the idea that there are a lot of brown bear on Mitkoff Island might be rumor more than anything.
There's a lot of bad information disseminated.
The State Department of Fish and Game opposes the brown bear proposals. Lowell says while they don't have precise population estimates for Mitkoff or Unit 3 brown bears, it's safe to say the number is relatively low. Brown bears move back and forth from the mainland to the islands, and it is believed that there are just a few bears on each island, except for Deer Island, which is closer to the mainland.
And because the population is thought to be relatively low, there are questions about the ability to have a sustainable hunt of those animals. And by mandate, we're required to manage wildlife on a sustainable basis, and therefore we need to ensure that our harvest of those animals is within, sustained yield principles. So
in other words, you don't want to open a hunt and have it last a year or two. You need to think about, can this hunt last 10, 20 years, something like that?
Sure, or longer.
The proposals recognize that more hunters are out on the land in the fall looking for deer and moose, which would give them more opportunity to encounter and take bears. There has been a spring brown bear hunt for Unit 3 Islands for the last 9 years. In that time, only 4 bears have been harvested. 3 of the 4 were sows, something that the department wants to avoid.
The fall season is when most of the females, or sows, actually get taken. The cubs of the year are venturing further from the sow, and so we see a lot of sows get harvested in the fall, or a disproportionate number that we don't want to see with brown bears.
The proposal that includes a brown bear fall hunt for just Mitkoff Island received broader support from the local advisory committee. They approved it with an 8-2 vote. The proposal for establishing a hunt for all of Unit 3 passed 6-4. The Board of Game will be taking up these 2 proposals and others regarding southeast hunting and trapping when they meet in Juneau, January 9th through the 13th. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Sea Alaska Heritage Institute in Juneau started moving into its new home this week. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Chief Operating Officer Lee Kadinger hopes Sea Alaska Heritage Institute will be relocated by the end of January. The grand opening of the Walter Sobeloff Center is May 15th.
Next door will be our new home.
Kadinger says from his current office at 1 Sea Alaska Plaza.
So every time you hear we're having a Native lecture series, it'll be at Sea Alaska Heritage. Every time you hear that we're having weaving classes, it'll be at Sea Alaska Heritage. Everything that we do isn't going to be scattered around in different places or classrooms or meeting rooms. It'll be at Sea Alaska Heritage.
The building will have space for art exhibits, demonstrations, and education. The main collections vault will be in the basement, the retail shop on the first floor, Sea Alaska Heritage offices on the second, and office rental space on the third. In the very center of the building, visible as soon as you enter, is a traditional clan house.
If we want to have lectures in there, if we want to have presentations in there, if we want to have smaller performances in there, it's really a flexible space, it's a multi-use space, and it's an educational space.
The clan house front will be carved and painted by Tsimshian artist David A. Boxley. The inside will feature a carved glass house screen and two house posts depicting eagle and raven warriors, made by Tlingit glass artist Preston Singletary. Other permanent artwork includes 40-foot panels by Haida artist Robert Davidson that will go on the building's cedar-clad exterior. Formline design expert Steve Brown created the glass sidewalk awnings that are already installed. Having raised around $20 million for the construction of the Walter Sobleff Center, Sea Alaska Heritage continues to fundraise for added artwork and exhibits. Kadinger says more than 1,000 individuals, businesses, and organizations have already donated. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Charity organizations like Love Incorporated and the Salvation Army are providing gifts for Fairbanks kids whose families were formerly served by Santa's Clearinghouse. KUAC's Heather Penn reports.
The Fairbanks Daily News Miner ended its long-running Santa's Clearinghouse program this fall because of local organizations' efforts to provide holiday gifts for needy kids.
Make sure that any child in the house from the age of birth all the way up to 17 and 9/10, that they get a nice Christmas gift.
Major Kevin Botchin heads up the Salvation Army in Fairbanks. He says the kids' Christmas presents are donated or purchased with money collected by the Salvation Army.
My name is Ed Ruther. I am a salesman at Seekins Ford. I'm volunteering an hour and a half to slot of my time today to help out the community.
Volunteers like Ruther and Salvation Army employees had collected over $60,000 as of earlier this week. The Salvation Army's Botchin says the organization is always looking for volunteers and donations.
Toys are always tight. We have toy bins at Fred Meyer's and Walmart, or you can go to several locations throughout town.
The Salvation Army has the capability of helping as many as 600 families during the holiday season, generosity that has a lasting impact.
My name is Monique Leva. I'm from Fairbanks, Alaska. Salvation Army actually helped my family in grade school when we needed presents, like a little Secret Santa, and I got a little gift. I got a teddy bear with like little cute little things, little books to help me read as I continued my education. So they've helped me a lot.
Families must apply for the Salvation Army gift program. The organization continues to take applications up until Christmas. In Fairbanks, I'm Heather Penn.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Matthew Smith in Nome, Dan Bross and Heather Penn in Fairbanks, Casey Kelly and Lisa Fu in Juneau, Angela Denning in Petersburg, and Tim Ellis in Delta. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Fish Basket Coalition, working to secure a bright future for Bristol Bay and the Bering Sea, where fishing means business. Visit fishbasket.org to learn more.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $10 million to nonprofit organizations benefiting everything from Alaska's youth to the arts to health care. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive and well in Alaska. So come on, Alaska, warm your heart by sharing your PFD. Pick, click, give. This message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil.
From resource issues to recreational activities, APRN brings you the up-to-date information you need for life in Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.